This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The silent film era has been celebrated for its innocence, but my guest Kevin Brownlow says the silent era has also recorded another America: gangsters, corrupt politicians, syphilis discrimination, unemployment, and poverty. Brownlow's new book, Behind the Mask of Innocence, is an attempt to set the record straight by examining films of social conscience in the silent era. For the most part, these are films that had been virtually forgotten until Brownlow rediscovered them. Brownlow is one of the world's leading silent film historians. He also collects and restores silent films. He restored Abel Gance's 1927 silent epic, Napoleon. MGM, the original American distributor, hacked the film down from 6 hours to 80 minutes. Napoleon went pretty much unnoticed until, after years of detective work, tracking down missing footage, Brownlow presented his restoration in 1980. He also produced a trilogy of films on Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd, which you may have seen on public television. I asked Kevin Brownlow why he loved silent films.
I think it's because I was a kid at school, and they used to show us films every third weekend, and they couldn't afford talking pictures, and so they showed us silence. And although I wasn't then so impressed by the films themselves, what fascinated me was the fact that you could have a cinema in your own home, you could have a movie theatre in your own home. And so I badgered my parents to get me a projector, and I got one for my 11th birthday, and only two films came with it, and they both only lasted 2 minutes. So I started hunting for more, and I found a whole pile of silent films in a shop off Baker Street, and brought them back and ran them to my parents. And my mother recognized Douglas Fairbanks and William S. Hart and Bessie Love, all the stars that she'd grown up with. So I thought, this must be worth something. So I went to the library, took out a book on the history of the cinema, and it fell open at a picture of the Douglas Fairbanks film I had. And so that persuaded me that there must be some value in these films. And gradually, I found more and more of them and discovered that they were extremely well made and extremely well photographed and actually more interesting as films than some of the stuff I was looking at in the local cinema.
It's so remarkable to me that you could have found footage, in junk stores and, you know, local fairs and things like that.
These were prepared for home movie use. They were abridged versions of complete features. And there were some very rare things on them. And, two of the reels I found were from a film called Napoleon. But the American films impressed me tremendously, both for their vitality and their technical perfection at a very early date. And so I started researching. As a matter of fact, I was supposed to do sport at school every afternoon. Instead of that, I went to the British Film Institute and began looking them up in old magazines. And that was a thrilling detective work because they had actually changed the titles for home movie use. So you had to find out what they were by a process of trial and error and just ploughing through all the releases till you found the description that matched.
This is fascinating to me. I mean, who could have afforded to have a projector at home to show the movies? I didn't realize they were shown at home.
Yes, they were quite cheap little projectors. You could they turned by handle, and you had the films lasted anything from 2 minutes to 10 minutes a reel, and you could sometimes get quite long films. In fact, there was a version of Les Misérables I discovered of 9 reels, which was absolutely stupendous, and you were turning the handle all the time.
Well, you get exercise while you're watching the movie.
That's right.
Well, a little later, I want to get back to some of the detective work you've done in your collecting of movies, and we'll talk also about how you pieced together the epic Napoleon. But now I want to talk a little bit about your new book, Behind the Mask of Innocence. In your new book, you write that silent films are usually seen as representing an era of innocence, but they didn't really.
That's right. As you asked me what turned me on to silent films in the first place, when I became a filmmaker, I felt that they had been slandered, that people regarded them as jerky, flickering, technically inept curiosities, and I wanted to change that picture. And then as I researched them, I found that the prevailing mood was one of sentimental nonsense, hokum, as the Americans called it, melodrama, and that however well-made the film was, people tended to dismiss the story as being ridiculous and antique and quaint. And I felt that there must have been films made about social issues of the time. There must have been films about the immigrants, and there must have been films about women's suffrage and things like that. I must say it took a long time to find any evidence of them. But once I did, it turned into an avalanche, and I was absolutely staggered that so many films were made that we know so little about, and alas, most of them have been destroyed.
Where did you go looking for them when you knew there was a certain theme that you were looking for?
Well, there were two routes I took. One was into the libraries, so that you look up the reviews of the time and read the reviews carefully. And I had some marvellous help from historians in America who kept their eyes open as well. And then the other route was through collections. When collectors died, for instance, in Holland, somebody inherited an enormous 700,000 feet of nitrate. And again, the title's hidden under Dutch titles. So you had to do the detective work to work out what the film was called in the first place. But among them was the most remarkable picture called Where Are My Children?, made in 1916, which was by a woman director called Lois Weber. And it was supporting Margaret Sanger's campaign for birth control, but it was opposed to abortion. And that was the reason for the title of the picture. However, when it reached Europe was in the middle of the First World War, and it didn't agree with birth control at all. So it completely recut the picture, retitled it, changed the story and the theme. And you can see one version in the Library of Congress in Washington, which is Lois Weber's original, and you can see the other version, which is as it reached Europe. And I thought that was an extraordinary twist to a picture which, again, is unknown, alas, but it should be better known.
It certainly is extraordinary. My guest is Kevin Brownlow, who's really one of the world's leading authorities on silent films, and his new book is called Behind the Mask of Innocence: Sex, Violence, Prejudice, Crime, Films of Social Conscience in the Silent Era. You know, the early silent movies raise a lot of interesting questions when you're talking about social films, because some of those films have to do with violence or sexuality. And this is the first time that people started asking questions about the degree of explicit sexuality or explicit crime that was going to be shown on the screen and what effect that would have on the people who saw it. What were some of the early ways those questions were raised, and what were some of the early fears that were expressed?
Well, right from the very start, when pictures first began to move, people started using them as an excuse. And the great train robbery of 1903, you can't get much earlier as far as story films go than that, already a young offender said, I was influenced by that picture to do this terrible crime. If I hadn't seen that film, I wouldn't have done it. and so the churchmen and the women's clubs, they started getting rather anxious about these pictures. And in 1906, I think it was, Harry Thaw shot the famous architect Stanford White when he discovered that his wife had been his mistress before they were married. And this scandal made many people turned into a film. One of them, I think, came out 2 days after the event. And this series of films were the first to show the working class and immigrant audiences how the upper crust lived. And these were the people who made their laws and control their lives, and the middle classes were shocked that such things could be viewed by ordinary working people, and so it made them, the Thaw films made them shut theatres down.
So the earlier censorship that you're talking about is really what precedes the Hays Office and the Hollywood Production Code.
Yes, Hays didn't come in until 1921, 1922. And he was brought in because there was a series of scandals in Hollywood which threatened the family audience. The studio heads realized that unless they did something, they would lose that vital audience. And they did what the baseball people did when the World Series was fixed. They brought in a neutral figure who became known as the Tsar of all the Russias. And he really did a lot of harm because he emasculated stories which would otherwise have been getting stronger all the time, getting more interesting, more political and more engaged, and he made them blander. So that the period of the great period of social films, where virtually every subject under the sun was tackled, was before his arrival up to 1921.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about silent movies. And my guest is Kevin Brownlow, and he's really one of the world's experts on silent films. And he has a new book on the subject called Behind the Mask of Innocence: Sex, Violence, Prejudice, Crime, Films of Social Conscience in the Silent Era. You might also know Kevin Brownlow as one of the people who restored the 1927 silent film classic Napoleon. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about silent films with Kevin Brownlow, who's joining us from the NPR Bureau in London. Well, during your search for issue films from the silent film era, you managed to find some pornographic films from the era. And I'd love to hear where you found them, what they were like, where they were shown.
Well, these were always amateur-made, and they were the first one I found anyway, was sold at a film convention in Los Angeles as a D.W. Griffith biograph, which I think is extremely unfair. It clearly wasn't. And it was obviously made by somebody who had access to a 35mm movie camera, probably about 1923, and very badly made. All of them are excruciatingly badly made. But I often have a sneaking suspicion, particularly on the continent in Germany, that it was the thought that they could actually make sexual images move that helped the invention of the cinema. So they go back right to the very beginning, and they're always just terrible. I don't think anyone's from any of those are worth looking at.
Terrible filmically, sexually. How are they terrible?
Every point of view, you can hardly see them. Of course, they've been copied so often, and they just show sex was performed in exactly the same way as it is, even though this was supposed to be the age of innocence. But the much funnier are the little soft core films, which were sold in 100-foot rolls, 16mm under the counter in the 20s, and there was one called The Finishing School, and there are a bunch of girls playing strip poker, and suddenly they're at a finishing school. A headmistress bursts in and says, "This is in the title. This is a finishing school, and you are all finished."
So, where did you find the films?
Well, funnily enough, one set of those films turned up in a air raid shelter in London, along with I think there was a revolver and a hand grenade there as well. So the fellow that owned them must have felt very protective about them. But much more interesting than those actually are the films that were made for the public on sexual issues, such as venereal disease. Particularly in this age of the AIDS plague, it's fascinating to see what happened with those. They started making them for the army, and they were made with no holds barred. I mean, you cannot look at some of the images in those of the wounds, the sores. It's simply appalling. Then they were remade when the troops came home after the First World War, bringing a VD epidemic with them. They started showing them in theatres, and once again the reformers felt this simply wasn't on. This could not happen. Sex education was absolutely out of the question because it encouraged people to do what they saw on the screen. That was the naive idea. And there was such a fuss made about them that the Surgeon General withdrew them. He would rather ignorance than ignominy. And so VD just spread like wildfire.
You know what I'm wondering? Say, 1950s and early 1960s juvenile delinquency films in the States, and these are like films that are a lot of fun in a lot of ways, right? But they'd always be preceded by a message, either from a narrator or on a crawl, you know, on the screen that would explain that. This could happen in your neighborhood. No youth was safe. And if we didn't take precautions, this is what would happen. So the film kind of posed as presenting a cautionary message, when in fact it was just an exploitation film. Did you find that kind of thing happening in the silent era, where under the banner of a cautionary message, you were actually getting to see lots of sex or lots of violence and, you know, other thrilling scenes.
Yes, there's that definitely was established early in the silent days. Exploitation films were certainly made, and they were made with those endless crawl titles, as you call them, and or a doctor coming on and with an endless series of titles telling you what to think. And in fact, a lot of money changed hands for learned professors with lots of letters after their name to put their their approval, their seal of approval on the film. And people learned to start darting out of the cinema as soon as those endless titles came on.
And what about some of the films about poverty? Were some of those not really so much social issue movies as tearjerkers?
Yes, of course they were, but there were also many crusading pictures saying this should not happen in our society and showing you a kind of poverty which we've forgotten exists. Many of them were shot on the Lower East Side or in the slums of the big cities, and they serve as incredible historical documents. But by far the greatest was a film of the late 20s called The Crowd, made by King Vidor with Eleanor Boardman, who was then his wife, and James Murray. And it's a picture as though it was made in the thick of the Depression, but it was made at the height of Coolidge prosperity. And it was showed a man who just couldn't hold down a job and what happened to him. And it is a masterpiece, and you could not do it better. And in fact, when King Vidor went to Italy and met Vittorio De Sica, he said it was seeing The Crowd that made him make The Bicycle Thief.
Hmm. Kevin Brownlow is my guest. He's an expert on silent films. He restored the 1927 film, silent film classic Napoleon, and he's the author of a new book about social films of the silent film era called Behind the Mask of Innocence. I think all of the silent films were made on nitrate film, which has a fairly short shelf life. Can you explain what the problem is with nitrate film, the problems with storage, and the problems with durability?
Yes, nitrate is known to be very inflammable, and as a result, people have created a scare. To such an extent, studios and private collectors have thrown it out. They won't have it anywhere near them in case it explodes like a hand grenade. But in fact, it's been an awful lot of nonsense being talked about it, because you drive around in a car with petrol in your tank, you don't set light to that, and it's no more dangerous than that. However, it can decompose because it's got animal fat in its makeup, and this is the most distressing aspect of it. It was expected to last 50 years, and the silent era itself was history 60 years ago. So we're talking about film which has miraculously lasted, and there's not a, you know, about two-thirds of the silent era is already lost. So we're talking about the remaining third. Some of that has already been copied by archives onto safety stock. Now, the rest of it must be done, because this is the last decade of nitrate. And if we don't do it, posterity will regard it as one of the greatest cultural crimes.
Well, I think one of the things you're proving is that we really don't fully know what the silent film era was like, since so much of the movies have been lost.
Particularly those years before the 20s started. We have, during that period, there was something called the three-reeler that was very popular. And the three-reeler, because it was an awkward length, was never kept, and hardly any of them survive, and yet the most interesting subjects were made in that peculiar length. It lasted, you know, about half an hour, 40 minutes, depending the speed you ran it at. And some remarkable pictures were produced, and some series about capital versus labor and about the early gangsters and the patent medicine racket. And it's absolutely fascinating.
You know, speaking to you is really getting me enthusiastic about going to the video store and renting some silent films, and more of them are coming out on video. I'll be honest with you, I've never rented a silent film on video. It always seems like it will be an incomplete experience watching it on a small screen without music, or at least without live music. I wonder if you've had the experience of watching silence on video and what you think of it.
Well, I think watching films on video is an incomplete experience. I think a whole generation has lost the thrill of seeing a picture in the cinema as it was meant to be seen, with an audience reacting strongly to it and adding that reaction to their own, and then they look at the same film. If you look at the same film on video, it's never anything like the same. However, there are some excellent examples on video. In fact, my partner and I, my partner David Gill and I, have prepared some, including Ben-Hur, the 1925 Raymond Navarro version, and Carl Davis has written a fantastic score for it, the Garbo film Flesh and the Devil, quite a number of them, King Vidor's The Crowd, and King Vidor's Show People, which is one of the funniest pictures of that period. So there are some fine pictures available on video, but they should be done with the best possible quality and also the best quality score. And that sometimes lets it down. Sometimes you get a silent film which is ghastly quality in every sense. The music, too, is just a piano. But that brings me back to the thing that got me going in the first place, that it was the technical perfection of these films which amazed me, that photographically they were always extremely good. And it's the copying over the years that has made them look, he's given them that murky look. And alas, videotape is not the ideal medium for them. You should really see a really good print projected with a with an arc or with a really good light behind it on a big screen, and preferably live music.
You restored the 1927 French silent film Napoleon, which was directed by Abel Gance. I'm sure a lot of detective work went into finding the film. I think you'd said that you saw the first part of it when you were around 11 years old, but that was just a small, just a couple of minutes that you saw, right?
No, it was a couple of reels, which would have lasted 20, 25 minutes, and it was enough to convince me that this was some of the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen. I go out on a limb and say it was the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen, and if the rest of the film is as good as that, then it, you know, I must get the rest of it. Well, it took years and years and years, but it was one of the most extraordinary things. The more I found, the better the picture got, until the version that we're running in Europe now is 5 hours 13.
Well, that's longer than the version that was in the States a few years ago, isn't it?
Considerably longer, yes. Yes, it is. And we're constantly finding more.
Where are you finding more and more footage from this?
Well, now footage is being dredged up from the archives of the Cinémathèque Française, and is not a great deal, but there's another 5 minutes to be sneaked in somehow, if we can afford to do it. But every time you put more footage in, you have to pay to change the score. And if I could tell you that it costs £2,000 just to Xerox the score, you can see how expensive it is.
At this point, is your version of Napoleon longer than what Abel Gance originally had in mind?
No, it isn't. Gance was forced to show a shorter version at the premiere, and it was about 3.5 hours. It sort of approximated to the version that's shown in America. After that, he showed an expanded version, and that, as far as we can gather, was more than 7 hours. So still quite a lot of it lost, and I don't think it'll ever be found at this late date. People think it's going to be an effort to sit through it, but it isn't. It sweeps you along with it, because the more you put back, the more explanation is given, the more innovation you see, and the more exciting it becomes.
What are you working on now?
David Gill and I are now working on a documentary for American Masters on D.W. Griffith.
That should be very interesting. What are you focusing on?
Well, the whole career. It's going to be 3 programs. And so we're desperately trying to find people who worked with him and who knew him. So if anyone is listening to this who worked with Griffith and we haven't interviewed you, please let us know.
Okay. Kevin Brownlow, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Kevin Brownlow's new book is Behind the Mask of Innocence. Next time, how scientists are searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. I'm Terry Grosson. This is Fresh Air.